Montgomery, Jamaican rum for Mr. Stokes. And that was what they were doing now, stoking up on their respective fuels with the steadfast dedication of those who haven't attained septuagenarian status through sheer happenstance. As far as I could see, none of the sparse number of diners at the two long fore-and-aft tables was stoking up very much on anything. There was a reason for this, of course, the same reason that accounted for the poor attendance at dinner that night. It was not because of the food, which, while it wouldn't cause any sleepless nights in the kitchens of the Savoy, was adequate enough. Nor was it because of any aesthetic objections our cargo of creative artists might have entertained towards the dining saloon's décor, which was, by any standards, quite superb. It was a symphony in teak furniture and wine-coloured carpets and curtains, not, admittedly, what one would look to find on the average trawler. But then the average trawler, when its fishing days are over, as the morning roses were deemed to be in 1956, doesn't have the good fortune to be re-engined and converted to a luxury yacht by, of all people, a shipping millionaire whose enthusiasm for the sea was matched only by his massive ignorance of all things nautical. The trouble tonight lay elsewhere. Not within the ship, but without. 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle, where we at the present moment had the debatable fortune to be, the weather conditions can be as beautifully peaceful as any on Earth, with mirror-smooth, milky-white seas stretching from horizon to horizon, under a canopy of either washed-out blue or stars that are less stars than little chips of frozen fire in a black, black sky. But those days are rare, and usually to be found only in that brief period that passes for summer in those high latitudes. And whatever summer there had been was long gone. We were deep into late October now, the period of the classical equinoctial gales. And there was a real classical equinoctial beauty blowing up right then. Moxon and Scott, the two stewards, had prudently drawn the dining saloon curtains so that we couldn't see quite how classical it was. We didn't have to see it. We could hear it and we could feel it. We could hear the wild threnody of the gale in the rigging, a high-pitched, ululating, atonic sound, as lonely, lost and eerie as a witch's lament. We could hear, at monotonously regular intervals, the flat, explosive clap of sound, as the bluff bows of the trawler crashed into the troughs of the steep-sided waves, marching steadily eastwards, under the goad of that bitter wind, borne on the immensity of the Greenland ice cap, all of 700 miles away. We could hear the constantly altering variation in the depth of the engine note, as the propeller surged upwards, almost clearing water level, then plunged deep down into the sea again. And we could feel the storm. A fact that most of those present clearly found a great deal more distressing than just listening to it. One moment, depending on which side of the fore and aft tables we were sitting, we would be leaning sharply to our left or right as the bows lurched and staggered up the side of a wave. The next, we would be leaning as sharply in the other direction as the stern, in turn, rode high on the crest of the same wave. To compound the steadily increasing level of misery and discomfort, the serried ranks of waves beyond the damask drapes were slowly but ominously beginning to break down into confused seas, which violently accentuated the morning rose's typical fishing boat propensity for rolling continuously in anything short of mill pond conditions. The two different motions, lateral and transverse, were now combining to produce an extremely unpleasant corkscrewing effect indeed. Because I'd spent most of the past 8 years at sea, I wasn't experiencing any distressing symptoms myself. But I didn't have to be a doctor, which my paper qualifications declared me to be, to diagnose the symptoms of mal de mer. The one smile, the gaze studiously averted from anything that resembled food, the air of rapt communication with the inner self. All the signs were there in plenty. A very mirth-provoking subject, seasickness, until one suffers from it oneself. Then it ceases.